invitation to this exciting conference and beautiful city, so I'm very happy to be here to share with you some of my results. So the title of my talk is Stabilization via Semigroup Interpolations. So stabilization will arrive, a connection with stabilization will arrive towards the end of the talk. And the main character, the main topic is maybe one functional inequality that is called the second order Poincaré inequality on the Poisson space. So it's sort of the iteration of the Poincaré inequality on the space of configurations. And this Poincaré inequality, and especially the way one can deal with this Poincaré inequality in an effective way in geometric models, is related with the use of continuous time semigroups on the Poisson space. And the semigroup I'm talking about is really the Poisson space counterpart of the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, which is well known in Gaussian analysis. Okay, and so this is a sort of, this is an interpolation between between one random variable and its expectation, a continuous time interpolation that has several nice properties and several connections with operators that arise in a theory which is known as Malyavin calculus of variation. So this is mainly based on joint works, one joint paper with Günter Last and Matthias Schulte, both from Karlsruhe University. And this is just one of the last installments in a quite rich now area of research that basically consists in obtaining probabilistic approximations, that is, mathematical statements that allow one to measure the distance between the distributions of two random objects by using, in a very massive way, what one calls integration by parts formulae, but very general integration by parts formulae. And this integration by parts formula, as I told you before, are very often connected to the use of a technique which was first started on the Gaussian space, but then has been extended to much more general situations, that is called the Malyavin calculus of variation. Okay, so some Malyavin operators are going to appear in this talk, and the other talks I'm going to give on Wednesday and Thursday, and also, I guess, in the talk by Günther, the talks by Günther of tomorrow. Okay, so there are some papers that I would like to quote. There is a paper of mine with Josef Sule, Uzet, and Muratako from 2010. And then there is a crucial paper from 2012 by Matthias Ratzner and Matthias Schulte. Schulte was in Osnabrück at the time. And this paper pointed out how some of the results that we had obtained in an abstract framework with application that we had in mind to Levy processes or Volterra processes were indeed very, very well adapted to the study of geometric functionals. So in that paper, the emphasis was on the use of U-statistics. Okay, so random variables that can be represented of U-statistics. And then things extended. So for instance, the topic of this talk allows one to deal with random variables that are not U-statistics. Okay, but this was the starting point. Then there is a paper that is going to be described tomorrow, I guess, by Huglast and Schulte about the Boolean model and the use of this multidimensional results in this train of research that allow one to deal with explicit central limit theorems in a multidimensional setting with respect to the Boolean model. Now there is a paper by Eichelsbacher and Christoph Thele of last year with new important estimates, and there are a long list even that it is not put here. And so as I told you, this theory had been developed on the first, there is a parallel theory which is much more developed on the Gaussian space. Okay, so we wrote a book about it with Ivan Urdanman. Here I'm really focusing on the Poisson space. So my framework is the following. So for every t, t is a continuous parameter greater than 1. So I'm going to consider a Poisson measure on Rd, which is going to be denoted by eta of t, and the intensity, the control measure of this Poisson measure, is by t times the Lebesgue measure. But things work in a more general setting. You consider more general measures, even with atoms, etc. But just to fix ideas now, let's just focus on the Lebesgue measure. And so for every t, in general, this is really the general framework, I'm going to consider a functional ft of the Poisson measure eta of t. I'm going to consider this functional as centered, so the expectation is going to be 0, and the variance is denoted by vt, and f tilde of t is going to be the normalized version of ft. So I divide by the square root of the variance. So now, my goal, ultimate goal, is to develop some techniques that allow one to do the following. So suppose that you can bound the variance v of t by lower bound, obtain a lower bound on the variance of the order sigma times t. And so we would like to deduce some rates of convergence, so and some bounds of the type that this, the Kolmogorov distance between the distribution of f tilde of t and n, where the Kolmogorov distance is nothing but the supremum of the absolute value of the difference between the distribution function, is less than constant times 1 over the square root of t. Okay? So since the variance is of the order of t, at the lower bound on the variance of the order of t, we'll regard this kind of bounds as sort of presumably optimal. Like, they seem really like that cannot be improved. Okay? So the variance is basically of the order of t, and we are looking for upper bounds that allow one to deduce Bariasian theorems with a rate of convergence which is exactly the expected one, 1 over the square root of the variance, 1 over the square root of t. And of course, n in this case is a central random variable with unit variance. Okay. Whenever I'm working with estimates that do not involve any parameter t, that are just static estimate, non-dynamic estimates, so I will just focus on the case where t is equal to 1. So I'm going to write eta for eta 1, f for f1, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this is our goal, to obtain estimates in the Kolmogorov distance of this type. There is one result that is going to play some role, mostly in the background in this talk, and maybe at a certain point a little less in the background, and in Gunther's talk it will be much more prominent. This is a fundamental result in stochastic analysis in a Poisson setting that is called the Wiener-Itô chaotic decomposition. And so this basically tells you that whenever you work with the square integral functionals of a Poisson measure, then these functionals can always be represented uniquely as the sum of the expectation of the functional f plus an infinite series that converges in square norms of multiple, what one calls multiple Wiener-Itô integrals of increasing order. Okay. So multiple Wiener-Itô integrals, very briefly, is just an iterated integral for the n, where you integrate a deterministic symmetric kernel, fn, and the integration is done n times, not with respect to eta, but with respect to its compensated version, that is the sine measure obtained by subtracting from eta the Lebesgue measure. And the integration is done by removing all the diagonals. So there are no coordinates that can be the same. Whenever two coordinates are the same, these are eliminated. Okay? So all the coordinates are eliminated. So these are really multidimensional objects that belong to an infinite dimensional space that generalize to an infinite dimensional setting the properties of a remarkable class of polynomials that is called the Charlier polynomials, that are orthogonal polynomials for the Poisson distribution. This really generalizes to a multidimensional set of the properties of these polynomials. And the important point, so why is this so important, is because most of the operators that are going to appear in our inequalities, or at least in the proof of our inequalities, are such that the eigenspaces of these operators are given by the multiple integrals of a fixed order. Okay, so if you fix the order of the integrals, you obtain a Hilbert subspace of your space L2 sigma eta, and this Hilbert subspace is the eigenspace of some of the operators, of the crucial operators we're going to consider in the following. Okay, so this is really the important point. So many computations and many characterizations of these operators implicitly use the fact that these multiple integrals are eigenvectors of eigenfunctions of these operators here. So I think this decomposition will play some role in the talks by Günther of tomorrow talks. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you something which is not very interesting, but it's a methodological point which is interesting to point out at least at one step. And so now you have two possibilities. So each random variables so can be decomposed as an infinite series of multiple integrals, and you have two cases, of course. Either the decomposition is finite or is infinite. Okay? And really the techniques that can be applied in the two cases are quite different. Okay, if the chaotic decomposition of a random variable is finite, so thanks to a result which is taken from the paper that I already quoted by Reitzner and Schulte, you basically know that this random variable is a linear combination of few statistics. Okay? And so in this case, all the computations can be done by simply first writing explicitly the chaotic decomposition, which is finite one, and then by representing the action of the forthcoming operators on each one of the terms. So on the other hand, what we are interested here is the case of random variables that are of an infinite expansion. So in the first class, the one with finite expansion, one can find, for instance, U statistics like the subgraph counting or the total length statistic of a Gilbert graph. And in the case of an infinite expansion, for instance, one can find the similar statistic, the analogous statistic for a nearest neighbor graph, and also intrinsic values of Poisson-Voronoi tessellation, the Boolean model that will appear in Gunter's talk tomorrow. Okay, now, if you have a random variable that has an infinite expansion, so you have two possibilities. Either you know very well this infinite expansion and you can control very precisely this decomposition, what Gunter with Daniel and Matthias have done in their papers, or you don't have access to this infinite Cauchy decomposition. This is exactly the point of view we're going to take here. So the kind of inequalities, the kind of results we're going to develop here, apply to the case where you have a random variable that has an infinite Cauchy decomposition, and such that this Cauchy decomposition is not easily amenable to analysis. Okay? You cannot analyze, you cannot control very precisely. You prefer to develop a theory that gives you access not to the Cauchy decomposition, but to some intrinsic properties of the random variables that you are considering in your problem, in your model. Okay? And the idea that we had, that it is to develop on the Poisson space a result that has been a concept and an inequality and an estimate that had been first introduced by Surav Chatterjee in a paper from 2007, which is called a second-order Poincaré inequality, a sort of an iteration of the second of a Poincaré inequality, one of the one-step Poincaré inequality, classical Poincaré inequality. Okay, so the original second-order Poincaré inequalities were developed on the Gaussian space. So let me start with the Gaussian case, and I will try to tell you slowly what are the differences and the difficulties of developing such a result on the Poisson space. So let us start with the classical Gaussian case. So let's consider a vector x, which is a d-dimensional standard Gaussian vector, and let's consider a smooth mapping f that goes from Rd into R. Okay, so the standard Poincaré inequality that goes back, also some people call the Chernoff inequality of a Nash inequality, tells you the following. Now, if you consider the variance of f of x, this variance is bounded by the expectation of the square of the Euclidean norm of the gradient of f. Okay, this is the classical Poincaré inequality. It is, of course, the fundamental result in the domain of functional inequalities, but it also has a very, very simple heuristic heuristic description that tells you the following. So, if the gradient of a function, if the square Euclidean norm of a gradient is small, if the expectation of the squared norm is very small, then this basically means that f is close to a constant mapping. Okay, and therefore the variance must be small, and the Poincaré inequality is nothing but a quantitative representation of this heuristic result. Okay, so this gives you, space to think about a generalization of this interpretation. And the generalization is the following. Now suppose you have a mapping f, and you don't know whether nabla of f, the gradient of f, is close to zero or not, but what you know is that the Hessian matrix, the matrix of the second derivatives, is in some sense negligible with respect to the gradient. Okay, so in some sense that I'm going to explain to you. So this means that this mapping, so the Hessian is small and the gradient is something. So the Hessian matrix is negligible and the gradient is something. So this basically means that f should be close in some sense to an affine transformation. Okay, to a constant plus a linear transformation, and therefore, since you are working with a Gaussian vector, this should be close to a Gaussian, the distribution f of x should be close to a Gaussian random variable. Okay, so it turns out that by using a probabilistic technique that I'm going to discuss a little later, that which is called the Stein's method for normal approximations, one can really put this intuition into good effect and obtain, so as Surav Chatterjee did in 2007, the following inequality that tells you that if you consider the distance in total variation, which is stronger than the Kolmogorov distance, between the distribution of f of x, where f is a smooth mapping as before, and the Gaussian n01 random variable, so this is bounded by some constant, with absolute constant, times the L4 norm of the upper operator norm of the Hessian matrix of f computed at x, and the L4 norm of the Euclidean norm of the gradient. Okay. And this is exactly so. And this inequality basically tells you now that if the norm of the Hessian matrix is negligible with respect to the one, I mean the L4 norm with respect to the one of the gradient, then this random value transformation f of x should be close to an affine transformation, and therefore the distance in total variation should be small, and this gives you exactly a quantitative view of this point. Okay. So in another paper, so some years later, with Ivan Nurdan and Genesin Reinert, we also obtained an infinite dimensional version of this by working on an infinite dimensional Gaussian space. So in this case, the gradient is replaced by an operator which is called the Malyavin derivative. And the Hessian is the second Malyavin derivative, which is the iteration of this one. But the logic behind this is basically the same. There are some technical points in developing exactly this kind of results, and we used exactly this result in both references. This result is exactly used for dealing with random variables that have some sort of infinite polynomial complexity on a Gaussian space that cannot be represented as a polynomial transformation of your Gaussian vector, but some much more general transformation. So in the case of Chatterjee, it was related to the spectral measure of random matrices with Gaussian entries, and in our case, it was some strongly non-linear transformation of fractional processes. Okay, so in both cases, things work well. So we want to obtain results that have the same flavor on the Poisson space, but things are going to be much different on the Poisson space. And let me explain to you. So our starting point is a result which is known since quite a long time, I guess. Maybe the first proof appeared in the 90s in the Oudrey and Perez-Abreu and the analysis of probability. Günther, correct me if I'm wrong. But, and then there is a very general proof in your paper with Matthew Penrose on PTRF. And this tells you the following. So now you work on the Poisson space. So you are considered a square integral function of your Poisson measure eta. And you can associate with each point x in RD, you can associate an operator, which is called the add one cost operator, which is obtained as follows. You take f, and you compute f not on eta, but on eta plus on the random configuration that is obtained by adding to eta the point x. Okay, so you look at eta as a random measure, and you add the Dirac mass at x, and then you subtract f of eta. So this is something that is used very much in stochastic geometry. And so the Poincaré inequality tells you that if you consider a square integrable function of a functional of your original Poisson measure, then the variance is controlled by the expectation of the integral over Rd of the square of the add one cost operator at the point x. Right? And then you integrate x with respect to the Lebesgue measure. Okay. And then, okay, and this is a similar interpretation. So now the idea is that can we iterate this? Can we combine this with techniques of Stein's method, etc., in order to obtain results? So now there are some constraints because if you look at these references, especially the one that we had in 2010, so remember that what we are looking for are optimal rates of convergence, in the sense that various seen rates of convergence that are proportional to 1 to the square root of the variance. Okay. Now, if you look at these references on the Gaussian space, this kind of estimates always bring suboptimal rates of convergence of the order of 1 over the variance to the power 1/4. Okay. So you really lose a square root. And this is really very much evident also here, because when in inequality you have two L4 norms appearing, you have a feeling that you have applied Cauchy-Schwarz once a little too much, and okay, and this is exactly the case. Okay, so these estimates are very powerful, but in general, at least in several examples that I'm aware of, they give you almost systematically suboptimal rates of convergence of the order of a square root. Okay, so really, really suboptimal rates of convergence. And so what we want to do is to try to be more careful in the dealing with this kind of estimates in order to obtain optimal rates of convergence in the sense that I explained to you before. And also, there is another point that when you work on the Poisson space, since you have a very discrete structure and you don't have derivatives, the other one cost operator, for instance, is not a derivation. Okay, so you cannot, you do not have a clean chain rule to apply, etc. It's much easier instead than working with Kolmogorov distance, where the test functions are indicators. It's much easier to work with the Wasserstein distance, where the test functions are Lipschitz functions. Okay, and so, and indeed, from this result, from this kind of motivated by this kind of limitation, one can always obtain rates of convergence at the Kolmogorov distance by using the usual inequality that tells you that whenever one of the two variables is continuous as a density, like in the case of a normal approximation, the Kolmogorov distance is bounded by twice the square root of the Wasserstein distance. But then once again, in general, I mean, it's not a rule, it's not a theorem, but according to my experience, this kind of estimates brings you, in general, suboptimal rates of convergence exactly of the same order of this second-order Poincaré inequalities. Okay, so this is not a strategy we would like to embrace. And also there is a last difficulty that explains the fact that our bounds are much, much less compact and elegant than the ones there, is that, okay, if you work on a Gaussian space and you are able to prove that the Hessian of your transformation is negligible with respect to the gradient, then you prove that your transformation is affine, and since you work on a Gaussian frame, in a Gaussian framework, affine means Gaussian. Okay, but whenever you want, you work with a functional for Poisson process, if you can prove that some analogous of the Hessian is going to be negligible with respect to the Adwan cost operator, then what you have proved is that your functional is very close to a linear functional of your underlying Poisson measure, but then this can be very far from Gaussian again. Okay, so since we want to deal with Gaussian approximations, in our bounds we will have an additional kind of terms that tell you that not only your random variable is close to a linear functional, but that this linear functional is close to a Gaussian one. So we have additional terms that come out from this additional structure, different structure of the Poisson space. Okay, so now the one of the main ingredients of this kind of computations is given by a family of operators that compose a semigroup, and this is called also on the Poisson space, the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup. And I'm going to give you now a description of this Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, which is close to a formula of Gaussian analysis, which is quite well known, which is called Mähler formula of Gaussian analysis. So this is a sort of an analogous of the Mähler's formulas on the Gaussian space. And it goes as follows. So I'm just defining this semigroup here. So for every s greater than 0, so I define eta of s as a exponential minus s thinning of my original measure. So that means that to every point in the support of my original measure eta, I attach a random experiment, all the experiments being independent and being independent also for Poisson measure eta, and the probability of success of this random experiment is given by e to the power minus s. And if success, then I keep the point of my random measure. If the experiment is not successful, then I throw away the point of my random measure. Okay, and this is a thinning. And also, so in this way, I obtain a Poisson measure that has intensity e to the power minus s times the Lebesgue measure. And in order to go back to the original intensity, I add an independent component, which I denote by eta hat of s, whose intensity is given by 1 minus the exponential of minus s times the Lebesgue measure. Okay, so you start at 0, s equal to 0, all successes, the original, so at point 0, t0 is just equal to the original random variable. Then as time goes by, the probability of success decreases, and you have to replace more and more points with independent versions. And when s go to infinity, your original measure will be completely replaced by an independent copy. And so t infinity, which is the limit of this guy, is just the expectation. Okay? And so this is in a continuous time interpolation between your original random variable and the expectation. Okay? And this is a semigroup. One can prove that it is a semigroup, and it has several properties. But what's interesting for us is that we, with this representation, this Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup can be represented as a conditional expectation of your original functional computed on some auxiliary measure, which is given by this thinned version with the addition of the independent component, and then conditionally on eta. Okay, so it is sometimes convenient to reverse the time, the direction of time, and to take a logarithmic scale. So, for instance, in the work with Günther and Matthias, we use this PT, which is T, computed in log of 1 over T, and so time is reversed in this case, and you have that P0 of F is the expectation, and P1 of F is given by F, your original random variable. Okay, so this is the... Okay, so why is this interesting? This is interesting because this semigroup is tightly related. I mean the fundamental object connected with the semigroup, that is the generator, is tightly related with the Adwan cost operator. Okay, and so the idea is the following. So now the Adwan cost operator is of course defined on for every random variable. You just have random variables can be expressed as some functional computed in a configuration. And so you can. This is always defined. But now, if you restrict, so you can restrict your Adwan cost operator to a smaller set, that is the one that respects this square integrability assumptions. Then, in this case, you can define an adjoint, which is delta. So the Adwan cost operator, when you make x the Dirac mass move, so it is an operator that transforms a random variable into a random function. And so the adjoint will be an operator that transforms random functions into random variables. Okay. And by definition, this adjoint delta is going to be to verify the following formula, which is called an integration by parts formula in the literature, that tells you that the expectation of delta phi times f is equal to the expectation of phi times the Adwan cost operator, the Malleavian derivative in dx f. Okay, and so this is the formula. And the crucial point now is that this delta d and the generator of t are connected by a very elegant formula that tells you that if L is the generator of the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, then L can be expressed as minus delta D. So you start with a random variable, you derive it, you transform it in a random function, and then you take delta, and you retransform this random function into a random variable. Okay? So L is the generator of the semigroup, and this is minus delta D. And there are also other, and then I will give you an explanation of this kind of relation. So now, in this relation between delta D and L also allows you to represent explicitly L minus 1, which is the inverse, that appears very often, the inverse of the generator, as an integral of TS or PT, or also the derivative of L minus 1 of some of these random variables here. So all these relations are going to be very useful, and all these relations appear much less mysterious once you use a representation of all these operators in terms of the chaotic decomposition. Okay, so I'm not going to dwell very much on it, I just present you the formula. So indeed, all these relations here can be proven quite quickly whenever one considers the following representation of operators in terms of the chaotic decomposition of a random variable. So if you start with a random variable f that has an infinite chaotic decomposition as the beginning, then you can represent the derivative as follows. So you multiply each, you start with integrals of order n. Then at each interval, you eliminate one order of integration, you leave one variable free, and then you multiply this by the order of integration. And what you obtain is a random function, and of course has to converge in some proper sense, and this is the Malleavian derivative or the Adwan cost operator expressed in terms of the chaotic decomposition. And then once you start with things like that, you can go further, and so your PT of f is nothing but the sum of t to the power n I n of fn. So you take a random variable, and with some chaotic decomposition, you take a point t between 0 and 1, which is a range of the parameter t in the definition of pt, and then you regularize this variable by multiplying each projection by t to the power n. So t is between 0 and 1, and so as n goes to infinity, this smoothens the variance, decreases the variance of the high order chaotic projections of the random variables. And once you have this, then you can prove quite easily that the generator is given by minus n infn. So the generator is just obtained by multiplying each projection by the order. Okay, so it is something that amplifies the variance, so operator that amplifies the variances. Okay, so in order for this to converge, you have to have that your function f, your random variable f, is very well behaved. And then, of course, not surprisingly, L minus 1 of f is given by minus the sum over n to the power minus 1 times the times each projection on the different spaces of multiple integrals. Okay, and so if you look at this, and then you go back to... No, back is back. Okay, if you go back to this formula, then you realize that it's just a matter of integrating each in each term and simplify things properly. And so it's really not very, very difficult. But of course, the identification of these terms with the original, with the one expressed in terms of the conditional expectation is likely much trickier. Okay, so now let me present something. So now there is a bound that is based on the use of Stein's method. Okay, so let me just give you a brief. Just a brief discussion about why things like that are appearing. Okay, so Stein's method gives you is basically based on the following idea. So that you have a random variable x, so it's distributed according to a Gaussian 0-1 distribution, if and only if, for every transformation f which is sufficiently smooth, the expectation of x fx minus f prime of x is equal to 0. So for every transformation f which is sufficiently smooth. Okay. So the idea behind Stein's method is that one should be able to provide a quantitative version of this statement. The quantitative version being the following: if now you have a random variable x such that this expectation is not 0, but is close to 0, very small for a large class of functions, then this random variable x should have, in a formal proper quantitative sense, a distribution which is close to the Gaussian one. Okay, and one of the main achievements of Stein's method for Gaussian distribution is that in many cases, when you want to to measure the distance between the distribution of a random variable and the Gaussian random variable, and this distance is expressed as the supremum over some class f of the expectation of f of capital F minus f of capital N, so let's say, minus the expectation of f capital N. Okay. So supposing that you want to measure the distance of this, as is the case for us, because we work with the Kolmogorov distance, etc., then you can associate with its f in capital H some transform, Stein's transform, f hat, such that this supremum is equal to the supremum, and once again for f into h, of the expectation, and now f of f hat capital F minus f hat prime of capital F. Okay, so this is f hat. So the amazing part, as far as mathematics can be amazing, is that f hat is as some additional regularity property with respect to the original f. So basically, if f is the indicator of a Borel set, like for instance any Borel set, then you will have a map f hat that is at least Lipschitz. Okay, so such that this f hat prime is defined almost everywhere at least. Okay, so there's some additional degree, and of course the smoother the test function in the original definition, the smoother the transform f hat. Okay, so this is some sort of a rule in Stein's method. Now what happens is the following. Now the problem is to compare, therefore, the expectation of this guy with the expectation of this guy. Okay, so the idea that we developed in the Gaussian setting before is that, so we assume that f is centered. Okay, and so the idea is that now you can apply all this machinery. Why? What am I doing? You saw everything. I can go home. Okay, so now the idea is quite easy, is that you have f here, and you can always express f as L minus 1 of f times f hat of capital F, because you just take L minus 1 and L minus 1, and so this is easy. And now you know that L is delta D, is minus delta D, and so this is going to be the expectation of delta minus D L minus 1 of F, and then F hat of capital F, okay? Because you have that L is equal to minus delta D, and everything is linear, so I put the minus inside. And now if you have this, you can apply the integration by parts formula that was there in the middle of this slide, And so this gives you the expectation of minus dl minus 1 up. Let's see. This gives you, the expectation of the integral of minus dx L minus 1 of f, which is the phi there, multiplied by d f hat of capital F dx. Okay, so this is just an application of this point. Now, if you were in the Gaussian case, I would already give you the punchline of the talk, because in the Gaussian case, you have that the Malleavian derivative is a derivation. So this is exactly equal to this, to f prime of f df. You have an exact chain rule on the Gaussian case. Okay, and so you can compare quite easily now, because you have f prime of f, etc. But the problem is that, of course, so this is the Gaussian. But in general, in the Poisson space, this is not the case. Okay, this is complete. The two things are different, because the Adwan cost operator is the discrete operator that has no attached chain rule. And therefore, understanding in the Poisson case the difference, now we have to measure basically the difference between these two guys. And this can be quite a difficult task whenever you deal with random functions that are, with function f hat that are not smooth. I think in the case of a Kolmogorov distance. Okay. It's not me. Okay. Okay, very good. So now we are working with the in the case of the Kolmogorov distance now, and this means that our test functions are given by object of this type, so the indicator of minus infinity z. Okay. And so I can associate by Stein's method to fz f hat of z, and now it's a problem to understand exactly the degree of smoothness of this kind of function. But what happens is that indeed there are some nice estimates that allow to tell you something, and so there is an estimate by Thele, Eichelsbacher and Thele, that tells you that you can, however, say something, and you can tell that fz x plus h, so f hat x minus h f primes of x of z, can be bounded in some way if you interpret f prime of x. So this function fz is quite smooth, except in the point z, where it is not differentiable. So not unexpectedly, f hat of z is smooth everywhere except in the point z, where the derivative does not exist, but left and right derivatives exist. Okay. Now, if you interpret the derivative in the sense of the left derivative in this formula here, you can prove that this is always bounded by... So by something that I wrote here, because I keep forgetting. Okay, so this is going to be h square over 2, and then the absolute value of x plus the square root of 2 pi over 4, and then plus, okay, let's try to be reasonable, h, and then the indicator of x plus h of z minus the indicator of x plus h, x of z, of course. So this is an estimate by Eichelbacher and Thele that basically gives you an idea about what the difference between two terms here. And this is exactly, so this kind of computation is exactly the one that appears in the bound. Okay, so you see all the terms that appear here, and you have to interpret h is equal to d of f, and x is equal to f. And then, okay, and this, the supremum here is in T, it should be in Z, etc. Okay, so you have this huge bound that takes into account the difficulties of studying the regularity of the Stein transform for a Kolmogorov distribution. And what's interesting here is that the first term of this bound in four parts is indeed, so is the difference between one and this inner product here. And it is not difficult to prove that one is exactly equal to the expectation of this integral dx dl minus 1 of x. Okay, so this, and so indeed now you can apply Cauchy-Schwarz to the first term, and this becomes the square root of the variance, and then the idea is that one can apply to this variance, which is inside the square root, the original Poincaré inequality, and try to iterate things in such a way to obtain a second-order Poincaré inequality. And for the other terms, the idea is that now you can use a trajectorial representation of L minus 1 in terms of the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup. So you use as much as possible the representation of L minus 1 in terms of the semigroups. Okay? And what happens is the following now is that, nice theorem. Now you can bound, now whenever you consider, you accomplish this operation, you apply the Poincaré inequality to the first term, and you control the other terms by representing at conditional expectations, all the three terms that remain, then you can bound the Kolmogorov distance between F and N by the sum of six terms. Okay, and the six terms here have an interpretation that is the one that I gave you before. So there are three types. Okay, this is a much more complex estimate with respect to the one in the Gaussian world, but it accomplishes all the tasks that we had in mind. And so the six terms that compose the bounds of the second order Poincaré inequality are the following. Okay, so these are very, very, very difficult to read and to interpret but are not very difficult after a while. And so I told you there were three kinds of terms we are expecting in the bound. Okay, there are terms that measure the magnitude of the iteration. So first of all, what's going to replace our Hessian in the Gaussian case is going to be the iteration of the Ad1 cost operator. So it is d of df. Okay, so it will be a function in two variables, which is dx of dy of f. Okay, so it is the iteration of the Ad1 cost operator, so the second order Ad1 cost operator that replaces the Hessian matrix. Okay, so now we have three terms. Terms that measure the absolute magnitude of d2 of f. So how small it is in absolute terms, d2 of f. Then we should have terms that measure the relative magnitude of d2 with respect to d, okay, because we want that our functional is close to an affine transformation, to a linear functional of our original measure. And then we should have some terms that tell us that our function is not only close to a linear functional, that our random variable f is close to a linear functional, but also that this linear functional is close to a Gaussian distribution, okay? As a distribution, it is close to a Gaussian law. Okay, so the terms gamma 1 and gamma 1, so it's a term that involves the product of expectations that concern both d and d2, okay? So the first term measures the relative magnitude of d2 with respect to d. The second term, gamma 2, all involves d2, so it's some sort of a measure of the absolute magnitude of d2. Oh? Then we have three terms, gamma 3, gamma 4, gamma 5, that have the same function. And at the very end, we have a term, gamma 6, that involves both the absolute magnitude of d2 and the relative magnitude of d2 with respect to d. Okay, that's fine. Now, what happens is that the terms gamma 3, gamma 4, and gamma 5 are exactly the terms that allow one to measure how distant is now f with respect to from a Gaussian distribution. And the idea is as follows. So let's say if the intuition is as follows. So if a random variable, so if f is equal to an integral of order 1 of some kernel, so that is, if the d2 is negligible with respect to d, so f will be close to an integral of order 1 of some deterministic kernel. And in this case, f of x will be exactly equal to dx of f. Okay, so the Malleavian derivative coincides in this case with f. Now, if you have a random variable of this type, then you know that the Fourier transform of this random variable is given by the exponential of, let's say, so it will be the Fourier transform in theta of the integral of the exponential of I theta f of x minus 1 minus I theta f of x dx. Okay? And now if you know that the integral of the absolute value of h to the power 3 is very small, then you also know by applying Taylor formula that this exponent here is very close to 1 half the integral of h square of x dx, and therefore that this random variable is close to a Gaussian one. And of course you can control the absolute value of the power 3 by applying Cauchy-Schwarz by the power 4 times the power 2. And therefore, these terms, gamma 3, gamma 4, and gamma 5, are exactly this. So you see the appearance of the absolute value of dxf to the power 3, and then to the power 4, and then to the power 4. So both, the 3 of gamma 3, gamma 4, and gamma 5, just control how far is this almost linear functional from a Gaussian distribution. Okay. And there are simpler, as I told you before, there are simpler bounds whenever one considers the Wasserstein distance. Okay, that is the supremum over Lipschitz functions. And in this case, the Stein transform is much smoother, and therefore the equivalent of this formula here, this sort of approximated Taylor expansion, is much easier to control, and the terms are just involves the two terms, gamma 1, gamma 2, and gamma 3. Okay. Now, we applied this to a model, which is the nearest neighbor graph. And so here, we consider for each t a compact and convex. Okay, I just forgot, but it's a compact and convex window of h, and the restriction of our Poisson measure eta of t to the compact window of h. And then, in this case, one builds the k nearest neighbor graph, so two distant points, x and y, in this random configuration of points, are linked infinitely if x is one of the k nearest neighbor of y, or y is one of the k nearest neighbor of x. Okay, so you build a graph of this type. And this is a graph which is due to Matthias Schulte. This is a random configuration, and this is the nearest neighbor graph for k equal to 1, okay, in a square window. And we are interested in finding rates of convergence in the central limit theorem that involves random variables over form Lt to the power alpha, where Lt to the power alpha takes each pair of points that are connected by an edge in the graph. It takes the Euclidean distance to the power alpha, where alpha is between 0 and 1. And so if you take alpha equal to 0, it gives you the edge counting statistic, and for alpha equal to 1, it gives you the length of the graph. And in order to enter the original framework, I wanted a random variable whose variance was bounded from below by t. I have to multiply Lt of alpha by Ft by the factor t to the power alpha over d. And in this way, one finds, and I think it's really an exact asymptotic in your paper in the paper by Pennus and Jukic from 2001. Okay, and so this functional f of t represents. And so we want to find bounds of the upper bounds on this Kolmogorov distance in the central limit theorem that's associated with this. And there were previous findings, of course. There is a bound from 93 that involves t over the power 1 over t to the power 1 fourth multiplied by logarithmic factor. And then 12 years later, in a paper by Pernos and Jukic, there is an estimate of the type 1 of the square root of t times a logarithmic factor, that with a power that depends on the dimension. Okay, so one of the questions that we're asking ourselves while developing this theory was, is it true that one can remove the logarithmic factor? Okay, so we can obtain bounds that where the logarithmic factor is removed. And so we have a proposition now. Now, remember, we have this big inequality that involves several times the second order Poincaré, the second order Adwan cost operator. And then at this point, it is just an exercise in applying the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality properly in order to obtain now explicit bounds that can be computed in geometric models. And our statement is the following now. Now, suppose you have your sequence of sets Ft of random variables, Ft, each one depending on the run on eta of t, and assume that you can bound some power which is strictly greater than 4. You can bound uniformly in t and in x the absolute moment of order 4 plus p1 or 4 plus p2 of the first add one cost operator and on the second order add one cost operator. So you can bound this properly. So in this case, you can apply several times your Cauchy-Schwarz inequality without fear of having things that depend on t and that cannot uniformly bound that. And what you obtain is that, assuming that the variance of ft over t is bounded by strictly positive constant, and that this integral that involves the probability that the second order differential operator is different from zero to some power is finite, so if you can integrate this kind of probability, then one can deduce the existence of an absolute constant c that depends on all the parameters that are involved in the previous assumptions, such that the Kolmogorov distance between the normalized version of ft is less to a constant times the square root 1 over the square root of t, okay, which is exactly the kind of optimal rate of convergence we wanted. Okay, and now, what is the connection? I think I have 20 minutes. I'm joking, the 2 minutes. So now, what is the connection? This is our statement. And so I'm just anticipating, in case Herman will cut me, that this gives you the optimal rate in the nearest neighbor. And the connection, of course, with the stabilization is the following. Now, we are required to bound something like this. So the probability that the second order add one cost operator is different from zero to some power beta, so we are required to show that this is bounded, this supremum is bounded. Now, suppose that there exists radii of stabilization in the sense that you already explained in the previous talk. That is that for every t and for every point x, for every t, one can attach to every point x a positive random variable rt that depends on the point x, that depends on t, and then depends on the configuration eta of t, such that the add one cost operator at x as a function of eta t is the same as the add one cost operator as a function of eta t restricted to the ball centered at x and the radius rt. Okay, so suppose that you have radii of stabilizations of this type. Now, if you have a radii of stabilization of this type, then you can express the condition, I mean, you can bound the probability that d2 is different from zero as the probability of the union of two events. Okay, the first event is that y belongs to the ball centered at x, and with radius given by the radius of stabilization. And this is exactly a quantity that appears in stabilization theory, where you can express this as the fact that RT is smaller than y minus 6 Euclidean norm, so it's exactly the kind of estimates, plus something more. Okay, so we need something more, because it's not possible to express properly, I mean, very neatly, in a completely neat way, a relation between radius stabilization of and second order add one cost operator, as we learned while writing, the paper. And so one has to add some additional condition that is given by this one, for instance, that tells you that once you add the point y to your configuration, then the radius of stabilization changes in some way. Okay, so you have to consider this union of probabilities and to bound these two probabilities in order to obtain a proper bound. Okay, and this kind of strategy works well in the case of the nearest neighborhood graph, and it gives you. Okay, of course, as I anticipated, this is very close, therefore, to the add one cost stabilization. So one of the two conditions is exactly the one in the add one cost stabilization, and the other one is something which is we weren't able to trace back exactly to the concept of add one cost stabilization. But anyway, so if one can accomplish this, if one can put this strategy into practice in the case of a nearest neighbor graph, then one obtains exactly the estimate we were looking for, that is, the Kolmogorov distance is bounded by some constant that depends on alpha multiplied by 1 over the square root of t, which is exactly the square root of the variance, the order of the square root of the variance. And so this improves all the bounds, previous bounds that I was listing in some previous slide. And finally, I think there are some applications we'll discuss, maybe, in Gunder's talk and in what I plan to tell you in the other talks I'm going to give on Wednesday and Thursday. Okay, I've finished.
Stabilization, and there's one type of stabilization where you ask What happens at the origin? Does that depend upon some random radius, disk, or ball, or cylinder around the origin? Then you have stabilization for the add one cost, which says, does the add one cost depend only upon some random radius?
Yeah.
Find any natural examples of where you have a statistic that stabilizes in one sense but not in the other sense.
Uh-huh.
Have you?
Or no, I don't have it in mind like this. I mean, all this strategy is really connected. I mean, this is not even stabilization. I think what we found out is that this concept of second order add one cost, which is closely connected, is quite natural. But the other connection is this one with add one cost. So. Yeah, I don't have a clear answer now. Maybe someone else has that. I don't have a clear answer now for this. Yeah?
So this add one operator we studied not in the 80s in connection with what was called air perturbation analysis.
Uh-huh.
People were studying various types of dynamical systems, function of Poisson point processes. Could you say a few words the connection with this setting at that time?
The connection between stochastic analysis and a Poisson setting and the use of add one cost operators dates back to a paper by Wannart and Vives from the end of the 80s. And so this was the first paper that made an explicit connection. That is, if you restrict to this, to restrict the add one cost operator to the space of process of random variables that have some additional regularity, then you can make a connection between the chaotic decomposition and etc. So starting from this, all this development took place. And one important point, so I don't know if this answers your question, is that differently from the Gaussian space, this gradient, I mean, not this gradient, this sort of version of the Malleavian derivative on the Gaussian space is not unique. I mean, you can choose to do things in a different way. And for instance, there is a way to define and I think this is connected with the literature. There's a way to define a differential operator, a true differential operator, on the Poisson space with an associated exact chain rule. Okay, and this is obtained, for instance, if you work on the real line by perturbing the jump times of your Poisson process, for instance. Then you can do this in a much more general setting. But there is a trade-off. Okay, this is something that doesn't have any counterpart on the Gaussian space. There is a trade-off, which is the following. Either you have an exact chain rule, and you can compute whatever you want, but there is no clear connection at all with the chaotic decomposition, and therefore there is a difficulty in computational difficulty, or you renounce to your chain rule and you define something in such a way that all the connected operators have a very nice and natural representation in terms of the chaotic decomposition. This is very typical, and it is not just in the Poisson case. Now, for instance, there is a huge literature which of interest to this community, which is connected to permanental determinantal point processes. And here you have exactly the same dichotomy. You can define things in such a way that you have some sort of representation of the eigenspaces of the operators, which is just basically given in the definitions, but then you don't have a chain rule, and studying objects of this type becomes very, very difficult, or you can define something which is a true gradient, there is a dichotomy in this, and I think this is really something. So there is a part of a literature where people try to have exact chain rules, and no, yes, I mean, that's what you are. Okay. No, I mean, I'm not advancing myself that much. All that I know is there is some exciting research going on in Paris around the Laurent de Crosfond, and it is about permanental determinantal processes. And so they have a partial differential calculus, variational calculus, like the one I'm using here. But there is no connection. There is this dichotomy. Although the part that has been developed for now is the part where you have a chain rule, but you don't have a description of the eigenspaces of the operators, and you can go in. And okay, so maybe, I mean, wherever there is some, I mean, it's in a very naive way of presenting things. Wherever there is a way to deal with this kind of objects by some this kind of this. I'm sorry. This is something basically universal. I mean, this is a general estimate. Now the problem is how to relate this to the expectation of f prime of f. Okay, very naively, whenever you have an integration by parts formula, you might have a way to compare the two of them, but it is not clear for the moment. But of course, the hope is that one can extend. And I think there are also papers that did already this for random point processes, whose distribution has a random Nicodem density with respect to a Poisson with some regularity, and there are some results by people in, I don't remember, but whose people. Yeah, it is your formula.
Yeah, yeah.
Less. Thank you.